Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Quite interested today, actually, in this episode. It's co-hosted by Nicholas Babin, who was head of marketing for Sony Europe for many years. And so he's also very interested in how social media consumer segmentation is key for audience intelligence to power strategy. And we are privileged to be joined by Edward Bass today, who is founder and director at Entsight. And he is a digital strategy thought leader driven by insights and data. So you've been doing this for many years, I know. And thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure to be here. Really looking forward to the chat.
Super. And you've recently contributed to the Forrester report recently, which is around this very, very topic, right? So, yeah, I think this should provide a lot of comms professionals and marketers a lot of insight, really, into what it's all about. Because I know you've been sort of combining a few different platforms to gain that insight. And I think that's really important. You know, I've kind of used Brownwatch years ago. Mm-hmm. I know it's a great tool. We've used Audience Intelligence, Audience, the platform who've, you know, kindly brought us all together to sort of get this episode recorded, right? But I think combining those approaches is very, very interesting. So I'm looking forward to listening to what you've got to say, really, because
sure.
You know, marketers, they need to know about social media consumer segmentation, right? But I think it's a bit of an anomaly for a lot of people, you know. So question, how social media consumer segmentation is key for audience intelligence to power strategy, right? So you combine GWI, which I don't know what that is, Brownwatch and Audience. And so how do you like integrate these three platforms to help people with their business?
Okay, it's a global web index, I'm sure. I'll be happy to, which is a great partner of ours. Is definitely worth de-abbreviating for this conversation.
Super.
Okay. So before I answer that question, I'm going to go off on a slight tangent and just talk about something that I think is really useful to understand the context here, because it's necessary, if I'm going to make what I'm talking about sound valuable, to underpin a bit of history. So first of all, Entsight and the work that I do now is really born out of a realization that I had over a career as a digital strategist working with kind of larger agencies and large brands for many years, whereby much of the research that we were getting and the consumer insight that we were getting was, even when it was coming from digital sources, was very much rooted in traditional research thinking. So it had quite kind of broad demographics. It had kind of quite broad segmentation, which, you know, up until maybe 2008 is fine, I guess. But the fact is, as a result of social media, as a result of far more kind of data point rich platforms, and the fact that we marketers and researchers and strategists can access this, have this wealth of incredibly detailed information available, but you're trying to understand it through the lens of a research method which is, you know, 60 years old. So given the opportunity by my co-founders to kickstart something like Entsight, which was originally focused on entertainment, which I can talk about a little bit why later, but then broadened out into everything from major brand sustainability work to working with hedge funds and alternative data. Really, what I wanted to do is address that problem by starting from scratch and building new methodologies that made use of the best sources of digital data, of digital insight. and the best platform. So I was given an opportunity to set the company up and really start from scratch. Now, I had a lot of experience with Brandwatch anyway. I've been working with it for many years. The first Brandwatch project I was introduced to was an early one for them, but probably one of the most detailed, which was tracking two major railway companies' social conversation, which is a lot of moaning and a lot of negativity, but nicely, as you probably know in Brandwatch, you can segment a lot of conversation and track it, break it down by sentiment. So I was very fortunate to have this, I didn't build it, it was built, I think, by someone at Brandwatch, but when I was at Amaze, now Killing Carter, I kind of inherited the system and then reverse engineered it, really. To understand it, rebuilt something similar for Transport for Greater Manchester as well, and also utilised it for projects for Odeon Cinemas, who was the digital strategist at Amaze for at the time as well, and several other brands. So I'd already had this kind of in-depth experience of using really Twitter and forum data, some Instagram and Facebook data, but it's always been a little vague. And therefore, when given the opportunity to set up my own consultancy, I utilised that understanding. But also, after maybe, 6 or 7 months, we also started to find projects whereby actually social data wasn't going to cut it. And this leads nicely into the point I'm trying to make, is that different platforms have sort of different values for different questions when it comes to audiences. So social data is fantastic for qualitative understanding. So if you want to understand why people do things, then actually it's very good for that, because you've got a lot of natural, often completely unprompted conversation there that you can tap into. However, knowing that, to get a little bit Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here, knowing the answer is fantastic, but if you don't necessarily fully understand the question, if you don't have more detailed quantitative analysis of the audience and their behaviour, so if you don't, for instance, understand their consumer journey, which you're not going to get from social, by the way, not in any detail, a lot of that qualitative insight actually isn't all that useful. And I've struggled with that over the years and tried to kind of draw out that information. But we started working with Global Web Index really because it allowed us to provide a source of understanding, just the behavioral aspect that we could then match with Brandwatch's sort of explanation of why people were behaving the way they were behaving. An audience which came later, even though I'd used its original version, Social Bro, way back in the day, just ended up being a, yeah, great as well. I was quite surprised when Jeffy had told me that. That really was the tool that helped us. We'd been using other things, but that was the tool that really helped us properly bridge between very quantitative survey data and very qualitative social listening data. So it was a very useful bridge. But it all comes down to the need for specific purpose, really. There's a presentation I actually gave with Audience and Pulsar at IBM, I think it was last year, where I was sort of detailing this for saying that, look, nobody goes on social media and really sort of tells you how they buy a holiday. So no one goes on Twitter or a forum or a blog post and says, oh, well, I search for it on Google and then no one describes that process. It is something that can only really be understood by surveying people and saying very directly, what's your customer journey here? Equally, trying to understand topics of conversation. So, okay, why are what's your main kind of motivations when you're going out for shopping for frozen goods? Actually, that kind of thing. Yeah, you can kind of directly address it with survey data, but some of that is going to be more visible through social, or for actually a much, much better example, and one that we've used ourselves, you know, which are your favorite celebrities? Which celebrities do you most talk about? Who's your favorite film star? You can't do that with a survey because the range of answers would be hundreds, you know, and someone's just gonna, you know, you've got, if you present someone with a survey of 250 answers, not that you probably ever could, they're only going to select a few maybe in the top 10 and move on to the next question. So that kind of detail. And then also, if you want to understand the sentiment around that persona, you want to understand the topics that are driving that conversation, survey data is not going to easily give you that, whereas social data will. So they different platforms speak to different needs.
Yeah. I mean, audience is a audience intelligence platform. I mean, that's in essence what it is, right? Like, it's taken me a few days. I spent about 2 weeks really digging into it, and okay, it's incredible. I mean, Nicholas helped me a lot to actually go through it all, because his background's, you know, from at Sony dealing B2C was really, really beneficial, because I'm more along the content creation side of things, and so Nicholas also is as well. He helps us to do various influencer work. So we work with some big brands and, you know, create influencer content, much like this, yeah? I mean, it's no different, really, to this, except for, you know, writing blogs and this kind of stuff. But yeah. I know Nicholas has got some more in-depth questions for you. He's dying to ask.
Come on, Nicholas, don't be shy. I'm ready.
I'm not trying. Don't worry. I'm just being polite, waiting for that to finish. It was fascinating what you just explained. I've been involved with marketing for over 30 years, as you can see. I'm a little bit older than everyone else. So traditional marketing, you know, it's something that I've mastered. But at the beginning, as you mentioned, customer journey being really essential. And obviously today, data-driven marketing is a challenge for it, especially that part. But one thing that I would like you to explain, if it's possible, is what's your definition of social media consumer segments? So at least everybody's on the same page, and we understand, you know, why the combination of both is so powerful.
My definition of them would be data point rich, or audiences based on very data point rich sources. So, you know, if you wanted, for instance, to understand the behaviors of people who are 25 to 35 years old, female, based in Berlin, like, I'm going to say David Bowie, because I've got David Bowie's Low just literally in front of me, mentioned Berlin already. So, you know, and also have, you know, a subset. If you want very, very detailed understanding of those audiences, then social consumer segmentation is really, I guess, the best umbrella term to describe it, as opposed to more traditional methods that would say, you know, maybe sort of CDE, aged, you know, again, like 25 to 35, female, but then none of the more psychographic or behavioural data points as well. So it's like I said, the first step is, that I found with clients, is getting them to appreciate that there is a wider array of information available, really. So yeah, that's that.
Well, thank you. So that really helps, because I do a lot of digital transformation programs with many companies, and I still have a lot of marketing heads of marketing, CMOs and marketing managers or whatever, you know, saying, oh, you know, of course we know our customers, we've done all these surveys, and I was really interested in hearing what you said earlier. I'm going to use it again, saying, you know, if you do a survey about a specific point, and your example was perfect, but you're going to get hundreds, thousands, millions probably of answers, and how do you then deal with that? When with marketing, data-driven marketing, at least you have better understanding and quicker understanding.
I will say one thing though, and I've seen this is a conversation that I've had with, I mean, certainly some European luxury CMOs and heads of marketing and digital, is it's all very well talking about web analytics and CRM data and survey data to your customers. But if you're running an enterprise that is only looking to sell to your existing customers, you won't have an enterprise for very long. And again, something that the Forrester Report definitely engages with is the idea that if you, yes, you can draw information from your CRM and your web analytics and point of sale and any number, mobile apps, you know, any number of owned sources. But you're only going to do that with audiences that are directly engaging with you. If you're looking to build your business to new audiences, which you need to do for survival, especially now, or you're interested in launching new product lines or researching new product lines, or just simply, and I think this is where the whole, I don't really like using the term because it's annoying and an example of the kind of broader demographic thinking, but you know, that obsession with millennial audiences that we've seen, you know, again, especially from fashion and luxury brands, it, you know, you're not going to be able to understand those by looking at your data simply if you're not already selling to them. And also there's the fact that yes, you may have some very detailed segments, but what happens when you get a massive paradigm shift like COVID-19 and your business gets completely flipped over? Imagine you run a cinema chain right now, for instance. How useful is your own data going to be?
Not very. you're preaching to the choir here. I have to say, in 1999, I sold, as Nat mentioned before, a intelligent AI robot called Aibo. And at the time, obviously, there was no web analytics, there was nothing. We were selling a moving electronic item. And you know, Sony's business is B2B2C because our customers were the Dixons of this world. And then Dixons had to sell it to consumers. And for Dixon, it was also like a huge challenge because they told me, they said, we're not used to selling moving objects. We don't know who the target audience is going to be. We have no ideas. And so if, you know, we have now, Sony has restarted last year to sell Aibo. And I know it's going much better because at least they have real data, as you just mentioned.
I wonder how many sensors and how much data capture a device like that would have if it were relaunched today, and I imagine quite a lot. I mean, I always, whenever people throw kind of those kind of problems at me, being a natural problem solver-y type person, I'm also thinking, you know, yes, moving objects, but also surely studying interactions with pets and also communities. Now, I'm going to hazard a guess, being a bit of a Japanophile that I am, and knowing Japan, and also knowing that Japan doesn't often have the space for pets, and also knowing about Tamagotchi, that the robot dog that you're talking about came about as a kind of a easy maintenance replacement for the Japanese as well. But of course, the Japanese audience isn't the same, right?
So was the biggest challenge. Because actually in Japan, it was Aibo in Japanese means companion.
So the
words are coined from artificial intelligent bot, but Aibo also means companion. And so the goal was to actually sell it for elderly, as you know Japan well. They have a lot of older people, and they are very lonely living in Tokyo in small apartments and everything. So they wanted to have a robot that could help them in case something was wrong, that could make them music, dance, whatever. It was really an entertainment robot that we wanted to put together. So it was exactly as your point. It's so different in Japan and in Europe, and even in the US. The US didn't sell that many Aibos because the US wanted to put it as a toy. Because for Americans, but it was a $2,000 toy, so they didn't sell many. Whereas in Europe, we really sold it as an AI tool, so really a technology object that was the beginning of robotic, and you can see a lot now, you know, many companies, including Google, is launching robots that are entertaining, that can do things, that can do the last mile delivery, and there are many, many things. But without Aibo at the beginning, I don't think we would be today where we are. But my point, going back to the subject today, was the fact that, you know, we had absolutely no data. And I remember on the M25 putting some huge signs, you know, saying, do you know AIBO, or AIBO is for sale and everything, and hoping that, you know, somebody would see the sign and would go and ask about AIBO and buy AIBO. Whereas today, you know, they get the data from the web, they get data from all the sources that you mentioned in Nat's question. And so it's a little bit easier to do a targeted marketing. And
was it Henry Ford? Someone said, I spend 100% on my marketing, my advertising, but I only know what 50%, brings me, right? I mean, they're still wastage, yeah. But you've got another really good question, haven't you, Nicholas? Yeah, there,
sorry. Otherwise, I get carried away.
I know. I try and stop you, but you were into the in the moment there. But you know what you're saying is correct, right? I mean, without the data, people like Edward wouldn't be able to grab all this information and then create insight, because that's really in essence what we're talking about, yeah.
It used and to be called the wet finger strategy.
It still happens. Big brands are still doing that, you know, and they're like, oh well, I like my social media tool. I've got my influencer analysis tool. It's like, well, actually, have you looked at the audience of that influencer? Do you know how many followers they bought? Do you know when they bought them? Do you know anything about what they're talking about and who they're talking to and what they're talking to, you know, who they're talking to? It's like, it's a fascinating topic, but go on, ask Edward this question.
And so according to you, Edward, who develops those social media consumer segments?
It depends. I will say, before I answer the question, is that there's not much in terms of standardization where they are, which makes our job so much easier. So the platforms themselves, of course, Facebook, wow, not that we get to see it outside of advertising very often, but Facebook has an incredibly data-rich set of segmentation and also uses some very clever AI and data science to make assumptions about this. So I'm always fascinated by the kind of assumptions that it can come. So it, for instance, if you happen to be based in London, but you're spending a lot of time in Stockholm and New York and Tokyo, it'll be able to categorize you as someone that's probably working away from home, maybe in a fairly senior role, for instance. So it's very good at doing that, but everything we know about it is assumptions, because they don't want to share it too much. So there's that. There's the platforms themselves to a varying degree. Something like Twitter doesn't really have any, but that problem is solved elsewhere, and it is at least open data. In fact, many of the platforms don't really, we worked extensively in the past with some of the Chinese social data platforms. And whilst there is a lot of data there, they're pretty light in terms of, a Facebook style data points, which is probably not going to serve, the white Weibos of this world too well in the future, if I'm honest. So there's that. The second one comes from the agencies and the consultancies like Insight ourselves, where we have the really interesting job of a whole range of potential segmentations from the platforms themselves, or to use the tools like Brandwatch and, of course, Audience and especially with Twitter data, because Twitter doesn't really give you any natural segmentation, not from the API itself, using things like Twitter bio and conversation on Twitter, that can be used to build segmentations as well. And conversation-based segmentations are very, very powerful. It's something that we've done some very interesting work with. And then finally, helpfully, the platforms themselves also have their own built-in segmentation as well. But again, there's no standardization there. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not going to say who, but I was attempting quite hard to get a social listening platform and a survey platform to talk to each other more actively over the past couple of years, just because partly because it would make my job easier, but also because I could see real value knowing both sets of data points. I could immediately see where one connects to the other, and if that can be automated, gives us a lot less of a headache as well. So it's that. So those three sources mainly, I would say. But again, the lack of standardization, the variation, the different degrees of data and data accessibility from different platforms it definitely makes the job a little harder than your average research, I'd say.
Right. So it's really about, it's like all marketing, you start with the outcome in mind. Yeah. It's like, well, you know, there's that peanut butter that's in, I believe it's in the report, or it was in I was speaking to on my last interview that I did about this topic, I was talking about this peanut butter and how that the audience was segmented, and some of the people that were eating it were bodybuilders, and then some of them were runners, and then some of them, you know, so the whole thing was sort of like, okay, so why does a bodybuilder eat peanut butter? Yeah. Why does a runner or an ultra marathon runner eat peanut butter? Mm. Yeah. And it's almost like, well, what do we want to find out? Like, you know, and you can go on forever, can't you, really? And micro segment these things.
Yeah. I mean, this speaks to another, I went through the report yesterday and kind of made a load of core points, about 10 of them, but that's another one that I flagged for myself, is that, yeah, you do need to have that intention. You do need to have an idea of the possibilities that you're looking to confirm, because if you go, especially to social conversation data and expect, and I've seen this with hilarious results in the past, thankfully not with myself or the team, but if you go at it expecting that huge kind of noisy needle in a haystack situation to surface something intelligible and insightful, you're either going to fool yourself very quickly and convince yourself that what you found is valid, or you're going to spend 2 weeks in a black hole of information and possibly emerge from it none the wiser. And that's, I've seen that before. Why we don't really give clients access to the tools that we use anymore, because it's just, you know.
Pointless,
No, but it's better us doing it because we understand the paradigm, but also because we're going to be more focused on what is it you want to understand. There are some situations. So we've had this, you were talking about, you were talking about celebrities earlier, and we've done a lot of work with what we call consolation score, which is it's a sort of a celebrity insight methodology rather than tool that we've utilised. And this has been used for people like Tommy Hilfiger. We've worked on them with some of their influencer and celebrity campaigns, and BMW as well. You know, there is a situation you might find where there's so many variables that you have to create, or you have to utilize some extensive taxonomies and categorizations and rules just to draw that out. Or go to the question with a list in mind. So it's always very good, we've found, to say, well, okay, you know, Mr. Luxury Brand, or Mr. Fashion Brand, or Mrs. Fashion Brand, or Miss Fashion Brand, what's your top 15 choices? Because we can look at those, and then we can explore the data in and around that, and maybe see what other recommendations we can throw in there as well. So that's a very interesting one. But then that also becomes the case. We've done this a few times whereby they've said, oh yeah, we're massively into, we really want to respond to this environment thing, we really feel that, you know, sustainability and environment and social good is where we want to go. But those are umbrella terms. There is umbrella terms as digitalists, really. If we talk about sustainability, that could mean a number of things, really. And so, again, categorization is needed to be able to kind of organize that language. And get all of that information into the right kind of data buckets, and that's when you can analyze, really. But if you just go at it and go, oh well, you know, I'm just going to look at word clouds and look at Reddit, you know, for a start, you're going to just see word clouds with Trump in them, because he's like a virus, frankly, data virus. he seems to just be mentioning conversations about things that he has nothing to do with. And there's huge kind of cultural mass drivers. We saw it with DiCaprio years ago as well, around the Oscar, that just dominates. So if you don't apply some very strong filtration, which comes from having some very defined intentions, you're going to lose that game. And if I'm honest, and this comes not just from my experience, but for analysts that we work with, if I could give the, you know, if I'm able to flag a bit of a telling off point here, especially for some brands, and worse for agencies, they don't assign enough time to that. So we'll have projects thrown at us where it's by, oh, we need to understand, you know, what is actually quite a detailed subject, but they've only allowed half a day set up and filter. It's like, come on. I mean, we're talking about days here, really. Yeah. It's actually, that's the bit you focus on. The analysis, once you've broken down the data, is the bit that takes less time. But if you go at it, you know, if you expect to solve that problem using social data in a couple of days, and you've, you know, you've given an afternoon to, you know, morning to brief and an afternoon to set up, you're not going to get anywhere. But it happens a lot. It really happens a lot. And the same companies would assign a lot more time to other research methods. I think personally is that it's because there's a feeling that the only thing you're tapping as well is trend data. But actually, a lot of good social segmentation and conversation analysis, historical data is very useful for that as well.
Okay. All right, my next question has actually two sides of it. One side you've already covered quite a lot, but...
Okay, sorry.
that's perfect, actually, because it was very clear. But so how is use social media consumer segments you mentioned? But my second part, and we can talk about that again, obviously. But my second part was really, what kind of KPIs can we see and how those KPIs can be valuable to the marketers?
Can I take task with you on that question? Why would you be looking for performance indicators if you're carrying out audience research? KPIs apply to your own organization. They don't apply to, you know, you're not influencing. This reminds me of a conversation I had with an unknown camera brand about 6 years ago. Unnamed, sorry.
But it's unknown you now.
No, they're doing all right. But, you know, there was, and it was that it came from a large consultancy as well, which is even more hilarious, but you don't get to control that conversation that you're tapping or anything from it. So why would you set a KPI? You know, there's no key performance indicator. Who's performing here? It's not the case, is it? So that, I think, and I'm a being like someone that works with language, I'm very hot on the semantics of things. If you approach a problem thinking that you need KPIs and you don't need KPIs, again, you're building a brick wall for yourself. So let's, could we rephrase the question? Sorry to be difficult.
Yes. you're he's right, actually. Nicholas, you put a trick question in there, Nicholas. Last time I give you a question to write.
Either he put a trick question in there or he's just been schooled. I'm not sure.
Oh, come on, two English guys against a French guy. No, the reason why I was asking the question is regularly when I talk about consumer segmentations and the use of that, I have, especially in digital transformation projects, marketing managers ask me this. That's the question that comes immediately. And I explain to them that KPIs might not be related to this, but I should have asked the question differently. How do you sell such an approach to one of your customer when you explain to them what you do? I mean, how do you explain to them the benefits they're going to get out of it? Is it better as a question?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I really try to not fall into the trap of approaching what's effectively a different form of research with the eyes of analytics, because analytics is something completely different. You know, if I'm looking at web stats, then it makes sense to talk about KPIs. But how do we sell them on? Well, I mean, we work on a project by project basis. So we just ensure that we draw a very, very clear line between what we can find out and how it can be applied to their strategies. Now, one of the things that I'm very fortunate, I guess, I do feel fortunate to have is a pretty significant high level background in digital strategy. So when I approach a project, maybe compared to just a researcher or an analyst, I'm going to be looking at it not just in terms of the outputs of the research, but how it can be actionable. And that's something else. I was talking earlier about what inspired us to set up Ensight. And another thing that's very strong was that so much research, either commissioned or, more off the shelf, often doesn't speak directly to action. And I think that increasingly, the more time poor brands and agencies are, the less time they have to actually figure it out. And actually, what they really want is for someone to be able to say, these are the insights, and these are five or six things that you can do with them, So that actionable insight thing, that's something that I've always been quite focused on. Because I can put myself in the seat of the client in that situation where you've got, I've got a challenge, I need to decide how to activate this new product, or I need to understand how to open up this new market. I think a lot of traditional research would lay out the facts before you, but then you have to kind of cherry pick. And I think, by the way, that's also led to a culture which I really have a bit of an issue with, if I'm honest, but it is too common. It's led to a culture whereby, because there isn't actionable insights and it is just kind of, these are the results, often that gives the client too much of an excuse to just cherry pick the ones that already support their biases. Yeah, now, I've had some pretty terse conversations with brands around this kind of thing. I've had to say in the past, we're not here. You haven't hired us, and we've never put ourselves forward to be an organization that's here to not challenge you, to just, for you to pay us, and then we just kind of rubber stamp your confirmation bias. That's not what you do research for. Yeah. Not in my world. But I think research companies have left themselves, and consultancies have left themselves open to that by not being concise or direct enough when it comes to actually providing guidance. So I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done in connecting, especially very, very specific digital insights to action. And I think once clients understand that, they normally sign up, because that's I don't think you like that, but even the ones that do sometimes aren't always the most amenable to being challenged as well. But I mean, I honestly don't understand why anyone would commission research unless they're willing to be challenged. It's not, you're not going to learn anything, are you?
Yeah. Well, how are you going to improve? Yeah. How are you going to improve your content, exactly, and improve your relationships and improve, because once you get that connected approach, just to kind of sum it up, right, we're basically pulling data together, and we're creating insights from social listening, and we're listening to all these conversations, and we're filtering those conversations and removing the stuff that we don't want, that's irrelevant. And then that information is giving us insight into those consumers, right? And then if we can take those consumers and put those into an audience intelligence tool, right, like audience, then we're going to have even deeper insight into the words that they like to hear, the behaviors that they may do, and then it's going to enable the brand to sell more because their content fits the segments that are defining themselves, I think that's sort of fair to say. Mixing these two things together is absolutely fundamental, right? But without an expert on those two platforms, you can't, it's very difficult. Brands just don't understand the benefits, I don't think, personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely getting better. I think it would be wrong of me not to probably point out at this point that with audience especially, one of the most beneficial things is that you can provide it a broader audience. So you can say, okay, you know, show me followers of Nike in South Africa who are male, interested in music and, you know, age 25 to 35, which already sounds like a pretty detailed audience. But then what it will do, and this is one of my favorite things about it, is it will then identify sub audiences within that audience, which is very, very useful. Even if you don't respond to each one, and you know, you not every campaign you can have the opportunity to sort of develop five, you know, individual audience strategies, but you can see the range and the flavor, and crucially, you can index them against each other and other audiences within audience. So, you know, that's really useful. Now, the indexing thing is something that we adore Global Web Index for, because it allows us to say, okay, let's look at a very defined audience, but then we can then measure it against another very defined audience. And with audience, that's a really, really good thing to be able to do as well, is to be able to say, okay, you know, this is my kind of Nike South African audience, but actually there's a sub segment who live in Johannesburg that really, really dig kind of funky hip hop. Can I actually measure them against the other segments, or maybe against an Adidas segment in Zimbabwe or something? You know, so it takes a while to get your head around. It did with us, but when you've mastered that, it's so powerful. I know I'm going on a bit, but there's an example I want to give here, because it's probably the most exciting thing that we've ever done with this kind of segmentation, but it's a good example of how it can work. I'm not going to name drop here, and I wish I could. We were working on a TV show last year with some contacts in Los Angeles. First time we'd ever done this for what we call Limelight, which is our more kind of entertainment sort of production focused solution. And project has been running a couple of months already, and they've been super responsive, and we've done a lot of research around, you know, different sort of potential storylines. And they wanted to know, for instance, how particular audience groups responded to certain socio-political issues like gun control, police brutality, which seems kind of prescient now, you know, almost a year later. And the client, I think very intelligently, and not something we'd continue, got an understanding of how we were working and said, well, look, you've got these audiences, you've got specific audiences. So, you know, we've got, you know, a character, for instance, who's like a Latino, 35 to 40. But they said, and then they said, but we also know that, you know, she does this job and she's got this interest and that. And this is the character that we're kind of dreaming up. And he said, is there anything that you can do to show us what real life quirks that character will have, and the other characters? We've been, you know, I suppose workshopping them a little bit with them for a few months. So we got to the heart of it, and they were like, is there some way that you can show us what this very, very specific character might have compared to, you know, their ethnic group or their age group or their ethnic group and age group? And the output was fascinating. It was fascinating. We were finding these real world quirks that different sort of communities and tribes had. So there was a really interesting sort of tension between the two lead characters. And what one of the things that we identified was that one was very, very kind of pro-technology, sort of almost, to, you know, completely communicating via technology, whereas the other lead character was hated technology and was a people person. And this is not something that had been suggested. It was something that we found, and we got very excited about that because we were being pushed to identify tensions in the audience. And there was this very, very, very visible tension between a techie and a non-techie.
Oh yeah.
But there was loads of stuff that came out of it. And that again comes across sort of contrasting and comparing very, very specific audiences. Really powerful. And I like to think that the likes of Disney and Netflix already do this kind of thing. But if you're not and you're listening, do it. Because I honestly think that, you know, if you're trying to find valid, authentic characters, it's there in the data. It's absolutely there.
Well,
I'm not saying let Brandwatch write your, or GWR write your script, but there's definitely going to be some very, very, I guess, hitherto unknowable qualities that you're just not going to see. And I think that's where audience intelligence probably has a really interesting future.
Very interesting.
With all that in mind, what do you see the limitations of this segmentations?
I think if you're using multiple platforms, if you're complementing your social media segmentation, you know, with data from GWR, your YouGov or Savanta, the limitations start to fall away. If you're looking just with social data, as I said earlier, it's hugely limiting. You know, that's not to say it's bad, but there are just some questions you're not going to answer. And often around behavior. So that's a limitation. In terms of the limitations that might affect the social platforms, don't underestimate, and nobody should post Cambridge Analytica, don't underestimate how socio-political landscapes can affect your potential research strategies.
Yeah, good answer.
Because look, TikTok is in an interesting place in the United States, but they were riding high 2 months ago globally.
Oh yeah.
And now. And Facebook, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Facebook was on the cusp of opening up their data set to a potentially very, very powerful, I wouldn't say social listening, but certainly social insight solution a while back. Which, you know, some of the social listening platforms would really bet their time on, and then because of Cambridge Analytica, it disappeared overnight. Which was annoying, but completely valid. A lot of the partnership data that used to feed Facebook Insights around earnings in the US disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always saying don't get too comfortable with just one data source, because we live in a world that is where this kind of data is constantly and rightfully being assessed. And we can't become too dependent on it. The next one's cookies. I mean, not directly the same, but you know, that's the next one that's in the firing line.
Oh yeah.
Driven, I think, by Google. So you don't get to decide. Only Facebook and Google and TikTok and, to a degree, the government gets to decide whether or not these data sets stay the same, you know, which is another reason why, from a very, very, you know, knowing this and having seen this disruption already over the years, and especially seeing Facebook just flip back and forth over so many things, I was quite nervous with Insight just to be relying on social data. So that's one of the reasons why we brought in multiple platforms, is because, yeah, if, for instance, you know, another Cambridge Analytica happens and we lose access to one avenue of research, we might be able to do some with another, but we're not, you know, dead in the water. When the Instagram API got pulled, I mean, there was a number of companies, mainly LA-based, who were sort of, I won't say competing with us, but we'd get mentioned in conversations compared to our own sort of celebrity insight. that were pulling kind of raw, dirty data from the Instagram API. And honestly, because I'm not merciless, I felt terrible about this. I remember, you know, once it all came into effect and the Instagram API had been rolled back, logging on to see how they were doing, and they'd shut down overnight. Yeah. Multiple companies shut down overnight. But then again, you know, to quote what I said to my founders, like co-founders back in the day, was I'm not going to base my entire company on the data from a company whose motto is move fast and break things. It's I'm not, because I think the chances are one of the things that might get broken when they're moving fast is you. So, so that's the risk. I think that's the major risk. And I also think that there's an ethical risk as well. I think that, you know, we need to be very careful. I have far too many conversations, especially stateside, with technology people who don't really seem to give too much of a damn about how their actions might be perceived, and I don't think that's right. I think we need to stop being so greedy guts with the data, and be aware that it's still very, you know, a very, very much changing landscape.
Yeah, very interesting. So just one final question to finish up. What is your vision for the future then for data-driven marketing?
That we adopt all the things that we've just been talking about, and then I don't have to explain it. But yeah, everybody just kind of moves towards where I am, and you know, I can just sit back and say how I was right the whole time. No, I'm being obnoxious there, but I of course would like to see our mindset and our approach and the way that we look at things. I'd like to see that adopted, because I know that it's effective and I know that it's right. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of unshakable in that faith, really, because it's just worked out far too many times. In terms of, I guess, the more interesting and less big-headed answer is I see a lot more possibilities, as the Forrester report speaks to as well, in image analysis, which is vital, and contextual video analysis. It exists. I don't know if you've used it. I mean, it ranges from interesting to hilariously bad, really. In terms of the results, I've seen some real corkers in terms of outputs from that. It's getting better, certainly, but it's difficult, you know. There's also the fact that if they master the image and video analysis, we then can't treat that paradigm shift in the same way that we've treated language analysis. We're kind of back to square one, if you like. We're back to what I was saying before, where if you're looking at, you know, you're looking at kind of text-based social data from conversations, which is still the mainstay of analysis, using traditional research models to assess and analyze that doesn't really make any sense. But equally, moving forward, if you use current text-based methods on image analysis and that mindset, including looking for KPIs, you're going to have exactly the same problem. So, you know, there's a saying, you know, the picture tells that as 1,000 words, and that's exactly, there's so much information just from the view that I have of you guys right now. You know, I can derive certain things. Certainly you're in the house of someone who likes a lot of wood. And that's great. it's the similar situation here, actually. You know, it's pretty good. But you know, you can, I'm trying to get a sight of what the picture is about. But you know, you know that I like maps, for instance, and books, and water, because I've been drinking quite a lot of it. And you know that I like the color gray. You know that I wear glasses. You know I've got very little hair. All of that information is, that's incredibly rich. That's incredibly rich. And I think once the technology has got better at figuring out and identifying all of that, we are then going to have to construct a completely new mindset and in order to derive information from that. Because trying to use text-based analysis thinking is stupid. It's not going to make any sense because it's not words, it's pictures. You know, images trigger different neurons in the brain. It's different type of information. It's like if you want to really throw away, it's like doing algebra with vegetables and not numbers, right? That's kind of what it's like. I think that's the biggest one. The other opportunity is sort of custom communities as well. So the Forrester Report mentions this at the end about, you know, utilizing owned communities a little bit more effectively. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually think that given the instability of social media, owned communities are certainly a way forward. So developing, you know, your own communities. I'm not going to go as far as to say your own social networks, but, you know, building some kind of fellowship around your brand that includes social and CRM and web and, you know, external experiential experiences as well. Using data from those sources, that's really good. But equally, I think that there's a real risk of bias there because, you know, because it is, if you've got a Nike community, then how do you get a more honest view when they're there being completely supported and, you know, fed by Nike? So that's a difficult one.
Hmm. I think those are
the two biggest technological challenges that we have on top of massive shifting social political situations as well.
Yeah, well, that's another
roller coaster ahead.
but no, that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Edward, and Nicholas as well for co-hosting. He, when I told him about this episode, he was super excited. Yeah, because we love this stuff, right? And you know, to talk to people who really specialize in these particular things. It's fantastic information, you know.
So. And I listened back to some of the previous episodes of this, and something that I really like is it's quite open, candid, direct conversation. I cannot stand listening to more corporatized podcasts and talks where it just sounds like someone is reading off, you know, a pre-prepared PR spec sheet. I don't do that. I'm pretty opinionated, and I figured out that you guys were as well. So I was like, yeah, I'm quite excited, and it's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Well. Fantastic. Well, let's definitely keep in touch, yeah, and we'll let you know. We'll let you know when it's live, and you know,
I'll be sharing that one all over my socials.
Super. And if anything comes along that you're interested in talking to us about, like influencer content and stuff, give us a shout, you know, we can have a chat.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we really focus on tech. It's all about, it's all about the tech. So very exciting.
It's a very exciting world to be in.
Yeah, very much so. So if people want to get you, we can drop a link at the bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. I just drop my LinkedIn profile. That's normally where I'm, as Nicholas is probably going to find out now, he's connected to me. I'm pretty proactive and just as opinionated on there.
Good.
On here. So yeah, that's probably the best place to find me. And if you drop me a message, I'll talk to you as long as you're not trying to just sell me something.
No. I'm not interested in all of that. We've given up hard selling.
Not you. That was to anyone broadly who might be listening.
Yeah, but people need to give up hard selling anything because it just doesn't work. It doesn't work, you know.
It's instant block.
Yeah.
It's instant block. I mean, I kind of like throw open the doors and like, yeah, I'll connect with you, but pretty much immediately, if the next thing I see from that person is, you know, especially if it's generic, I might give it a bit more patience if it's tailored, but... If it's just some generic spam, it's like, mate, you're talking to a social media digital strategist here. That's like you're really doing it wrong.
Yeah. No, I had a woman yesterday. She sent me some message about blockchain. And I was like, she's like, do you know
is that still a thing?
Yeah, but she's like, she's like, I work for blockchain.com. Like, and I'm like, okay, really? That's interesting. She sent me something saying something about blockchain. And I'm like, I'm like, she's like, do you understand about blockchain? I'm like, have you read my profile? That's what I said to her. No response.
Yeah, I've given up even being acerbic now. I'm just like, I don't know. Yeah. It's no, you know, I almost feel that if I don't want to be bitchy because I used to be a sales guy myself back in the day, but like, I almost feel that if I respond with something kind of pointed and directional, they might almost be able to convince themselves that it's a lead. And it's at least he's talking to me. It's like, no, just I'm not going to give you any hope. No. Just going to block you. So there you go. You've been warned. But yeah, I'm pretty chatty on there. Cool. And more than happy to engage. And you know, if there's any projects where you're looking to understand more about your audiences, or you want to sort of pick up any points that I've mentioned here, drop me a message.
Super, super. Great. Well, thanks ever so much, both of you, and to everyone for listening. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.